Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. Hello, listeners to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name is Rob Farley, and today we are going to talk some NFL football. With me today is Eric Loomis and Scott Lemieux, both of whom you should know from being longtime front pagers at Lawyers, Guns, and Money. How are you guys doing today?
Hello.
How's it going?
Well, you know, I think it's going terrific. I think we're going to try to work our way through the general divisional structure of the NFL, but I want to start with perhaps the unusual of place, which would be the Cleveland Browns. And I honestly don't even know which division they're in anymore. But I know that the Browns are near and dear to my heart because they got absolutely crushed by the Tennessee Titans, who are apparently now my favorite team, in what was really, I think, a stunning rebuke to the tanking strategy that the Browns have adopted and that so many Browns fans that we know and love were just wildly optimistic about. So I know, Scott, you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, and I should preface, you know, so I think longtime readers will know that I've sort of started to push back against this Silicon Valley tanking theory. And I'll post about it either at LGM or somewhere else. But there were like The Ringer, which I like a lot, but in the NFL preview season was just publishing like an article a day about how like the Browns were like the model franchise for the NFL. And this idea that like the 76ers and the Browns represent the, you know, cutting edge model organizations. And I'm like, these teams have accomplished nothing. Like, the 76ers have won two playoff rounds, you know, and they're a promising young team that may succeed or may not. But in the Browns' case, it's even more ridiculous. Like, literally, they won seven games last year. And I think that the, you know, and I should preface, you know, I like Baker Mayfield. Like, I'm actually relatively bullish on the Browns. They have some young talent. But the real issue here, like, to justify tanking, the question isn't whether Mayfield is good. It's the question is, was Baker Mayfield the only good quarterback available in the last three NFL drafts that they had to keep tanking for him? And the answer to that is obviously not. You know, the best quarterback in those drafts was Patrick Mahomes, who the Chiefs got at 10th overall. There's also been Deshaun Watson and you know, several others. And the most obvious one is Carson Wentz. And that's the really striking thing, is that one of the teams that the Browns traded with, and what Mike Tannier calls their, you know, extreme tantric vegan moneyballism, the Philadelphia Eagles, you know, acquired Carson Wentz and won a fucking Super Bowl while the Browns were going 0-16. So it's not really clear to me why the Browns are this incredible modern organization that's hacked football, not the Eagles. And as we may have mentioned in our blog once or twice, it's not like the Eagles roster was in good shape after the Chip Kelly GM experience. You know, they didn't walk into this stacked team, but they were able to, you know, literally put a Super Bowl team together, you know, within the year. So that's, you know, the issue is not so much like, you know, and again, I think the Browns could still be like fairly decent this year, but I just don't understand this idea that, like, you know, we've hacked things and tanking is by far the best way of building a team. And in particular, I don't think we should be anointing the Browns as one of the best organizations in the NFL until they've at least had a winning season. Like, that seems like a, you know, like why are they considered a better organization than the Ravens and Steelers, two teams in their division, which like win every year? And the Ravens have a young quarterback who looks pretty damn good. You know, I know it's the Dolphins, but still, you know, that it's, you know, it's not even obvious that Mayfield was the best young quarterback in the division yet. So that's really it.
Pretty good for a running back is, I think, what he said, yeah, the way he phrased it, Lamar Jackson.
That was a tremendous press conference. Yeah. So, I mean, it really is, you know, so that's the real issue. It's not so much that the Browns are bad or even that I'm rooting against them. It's just that I just don't understand this idea. And it's particularly like how many like otherwise skeptical people don't really seem to understand that the beauty of tanking is that you can't criticize anything management does for like 3 years. Like, literally, you know, if you lose, you're winning. You know, if you win more quickly, you're like, you know, that really it's just a way of like insulating management from accountability. And so I don't know why so many otherwise smart people are sort of, you know, falling for it.
Eric, do you have strong thoughts on this Browns question?
I guess what I have a couple of thoughts actually on it. I mean, first, I think that it's very reflective. Sports always reflects society as a whole. And, you know, I think it's very reflective, this kind of talk about the Browns that Scott was going into is reflected about the way that we talk about technology and so-called disruption as a whole in our society, so that, you know, Uber and Lyft are these incredibly, you know, innovative companies because they recreate a livery service is a, you know, and yet they're seen as these sort of saviors or the ways that, you know, it's sort of like Presti, right? Is that the GM of the 76ers? Who was the douchey GM of the 76ers? His name is
Sam Hinkie, right?
Yeah. Elon Musk is kind of like the version of that guy for the broader society. It's sort of this sort of belief that these people are completely changing the world through what is really just very basic math. That if we get more high draft picks, we're going to do well, as if nobody ever thought that before. And I think that the way that these kind of rhetoric gets talked about, even among people who should know better, people like liberals and things like that. Ours is quite telling. I mean, because the Browns, again, haven't done anything. And I also think that it's very questionable whether, especially in football, it's worth alienating a fan base over the long term just so that maybe someday you can win some games. And I guess I can sort of see how this works in basketball. You know, maybe even though the Sixers bombed as many of those picks as anybody possibly could have, I guess finally when Embiid got healthy, that they became, you know, pretty good. But in football, where you need so many players to have a good team, And it just does not make that much sense to go into long-term tanking. And I don't really see, to move from the Browns, what the Dolphins are doing here. To me, that is an utter disaster in the making. A team that's already alienated its fan base over the last 20 years by being crappy, going into, you know, epic terribleness for a series of several years, so that maybe in an NFL where the success rate of even first round draft picks is pretty iffy, that this is somehow going to pay off with this super team. It's really skeptical. And you know, they're going to draft a quarterback this year, presumably, whether it's Tua or Herbert or whoever, and they're just going to, you know, feed them to the dogs. And we saw what happened when, you know, David Carr got drafted by the Texans and was sacked 5,000 times a year and his career was ruined. And, you know, we've mm-hmm. seen how hard it is for Mariota to develop into a decent quarterback because he's been surrounded by crap for so many years. And so even if they draft to, let's say, first, he's an amazing talent, there's a good chance he's going to be destroyed by the lack of quality around him. And so I just feel like within football, not only is it no guarantee to succeed, but it seems an even more dubious strategy than it does basketball.
And the irony being that even though I sort of see it in theory in basketball, it's never actually worked in practice. If you look at actual NBA championship teams, they're literally almost never built around like top three picks that the team picked itself. They're based around like either stars that were discovered after the top three or players that were top three picks, but that came as free agents because people only want to come to a winning team. You know?
Right.
So even in the NBA, it's only theoretical. But you're right. I mean, I think this is one thing, and you see, you know, is that I think one thing that this kind of Silicon Valley tanking theory misses is that it just sort of assumes that players are going to develop the same way, you know, no matter what team they come on to, but that's not true. You know, players are not going to develop the same way for Hugh Jackson that they will for Bill Belichick. You know, that's not the way, you know, that's just not the way things work. There's a big difference between having defensive backs being coached up by Freddie Kitchens and being coached up by Pete Carroll. So you can't just, you know, and we've seen this in other sports too. You know, in the NHL, you know, two teams tore themselves down to the studs to try to get Connor McDavid and another team backed into him. And all three are still horrible 3 years later. Like, but it's somehow like the teams that tank and fail, you never hear about. You know, so that on the one hand, there's this incredibly low bar for success where a team tanks, wins, you know, 8 games in 3 years, and they're like one of the model organizations of professional sports. But like, we always forget about those teams who are just bad every year, who get, you know, your Buccaneers and these other teams who get high draft picks year after year after year and don't succeed. And again, like maybe Jameis Winston was never cut out to be that good, but we also don't know how we would have developed in another organization, that it's possible that he might have been better. And of course, you know, we'll get to this, but obviously Mariota to some degree, like he's seen as a disappointment, but, you know, we had to deal with, you know, his formative years being everybody beats the Wiz and exotic Smash Mouth. And you'd have to think that in a different coaching arrangement, he would have done better. So I think that's the other. And I will say about the Dolphins thing that it's tricky in that, to be honest, I do sort of feel the Tunsil-Stills trade was an offer they can't refuse because they got so much value. And frankly, Tunsil and Stills are the sort of like they're useful players for a good team, but they're not going to really move the needle for a bad. You know, so it's not like, you know, put in like a decent left tackle and the Dolphins are going to look good, you know, or something. So like some, you know, I think that there's an interesting rebuilding and tanking. And I understand that like sometimes you sort of have to make those moves. But the problem is like the Dolphins just unnecessarily let a lot of other veterans go without getting anything. And you know, and that's incidentally, Bill Barnwell pointed this out in his broadcast. Like, you know, the Browns left, you know, their left some excellent offensive linemen go for nothing during their tanking phase. And looking Sunday, I think they could use those pieces. You know, that like I understand if you're rebuilding, somebody offers you two first round draft picks for a decent left tackle and an okay number two wide receiver. Fine, make that trade. I agree. You know, that's worth it. But that doesn't mean that you literally have to trade anything of value that your franchise has. I mean, I think that's the big difference. So my critique of the Dolphins isn't so much the Tunsil trade as, you know, not making any effort to retain Cameron Wake, who looked amazing on Sunday, or, you know, that you can retain. Like, it's still good to have some base of veteran talent because it's just very difficult to evaluate and develop players when your team is hopelessly bad.
Let me add one more thing to this, which is that if you look at who the most successful quarterbacks have been over the last 15 years and who's developing into the next great quarterbacks, they're almost all quarterbacks who are entering into already functioning teams. Right. You know, Rodgers came into a great situation. Brady obviously came into a team that was good. And Roethlisberger, you know, came into a team that was not a tire fire anyway. But even more recently, you know, yeah, Mahomes comes into a Chiefs organization that is not a disaster. Right. That is a functioning organization. Russell Wilson the same way. You know, Lamar Jackson now the same way. Like these quarterbacks that are succeeding, you know, are by and large coming into teams that actually have pre-existing functioning organizations that people respect and that free agents will go and sign with because they know that they're going to have a chance to compete there.
Yeah, and also, all those quarterbacks are rebuked to the idea that you could only get a good quarterback if you tank and get a top three pick. You know, Rodgers fell to, what, 20th?
About 25, I think.
Yeah, in a draft in which, as I pointed out before, there were like four unimpressive running back prospects taken, you know, before him. Of course, Russell Wilson, as we know, was literally drafted behind a punter in the third round. I believe Jackson was the last pick of the first round, right?
That's right. I think he was traded. They traded back up to grab him.
Yeah,
Mahomes. Well, I think Dak Prescott's another example for, you know, a very clear example for somebody who comes in and, you know, turns into a pretty functional quarterback at a low draft pick.
Yeah, fourth rounder, right? Yeah, right. So that's the thing is that, you know, that obviously high draft picks are better than low draft picks, but it's also a very inexact science. So it's simply not true that you can't find a good quarterback if you don't have a top three pick. And, you know, especially as Eric says, you know, a good organization, you know, can often develop. You know, that I think Patrick Mahomes would be good in almost any context. But, you know, he's a lot better playing for Andy Reid, who, whatever his game management issues, is an outstanding, you know, evaluator and developer of quarterback talent, you know, than he would in another franchise. You know, throw Patrick Mahomes onto the Pew Kitchen. Well, and note that even Mayfield didn't play well at all until they fired Hugh. So, you know, there's only so much that, you know, talent matters, but, you know, that especially in a game like football, you know, you have to be, you know, have an infrastructure around you to be able to succeed. And the problem with tanking is that, you know, you come in and it could be that Tua is just so good that he's able to succeed anyway. But I will say this, that if the Dolphins are going to draft him, they better make a lot of efforts to improve the team immediately. And incidentally, that's Baltimore is an excellent example of that. Really had just an excellent draft and an excellent offseason and really gave Jackson the tools he needed to succeed. And, you know, again, I'm not going to read too much into 1 week against the worst team in the league. But, you know, look, there have been a lot of bad teams over the years and not many performances like Jackson's. And the Dolphins, really, right. Their defense, especially their secondary, is really not terrible. So, you know, I think that almost people are discounting it too much. I think part of it is that the Dolphins are awful, but I also think that the Ravens offense looks really good. And again, I think that the Ravens are a much more plausible model franchise for the NFL than the Browns are right now.
Right. And so, I mean, my take on this, and the reason that I'm, you know, I am actually, I now define myself as sort of firmly anti-Browns, right, is that, kick them all there down as far as I'm concerned, right? Yeah. I think that it is a pretty awful thing, not just for sort of thinking about it from an individual team's perspective, right, where, you know, a team, is this going to work or is this not going to work for a team? A world in which, you know, many teams theorize that this sort of thing is going to work, and even when it does, is a much worse world than where teams are sort of continuously trying to rebuild, right? And so that's why I think, in some ways, this matchup last week between the Titans and the Browns was really sort of useful, and I think sort of the Titans were on the side of good here, right? I mean, they're a team that's gone 9-7 3 years in a row. They have one playoff win. They have one playoff loss, right? You know, Mariota, we will all grant, has not been amazingly successful in this. He hasn't quite been a bust either, right? But when we count what the Titans have done over the past 3 years as a success, right, which is winning, you know, going 27-21, right, whereas the Browns have gone, you know, something much, much worse than that, that makes for a much more interesting NFL, right? It makes for a much more watchable National Football League when general managers and fans and journalists think about this as like, oh, you know, okay, well, it's not that bad, right? I mean, they go in every year with more or less of a chance of winning the division, and who knows what happens if you win the division or if you get to the wild card, right? And so this is something that should be regarded as a success. And so, you know, a team that comes down to a choice between, you know, all right, we can choose between a 9-7 season, between projecting a 9-7 season, or we can tear everything down and go 2-14 and then pray, right? We want teams to be making decisions to kind of look like the Titans do, right? To kind of look like the Titans do, and, you know, just sort of hoping that something comes together, and playing along the way, you know, reasonably entertaining football, right? I mean, they're not the most entertaining team in the world, but they're not the least either. Right. I mean, they were fun to watch at times last year.
I mean, one of the problems is that the Silicon Valley model has the potential to make watching sports very boring. You know, right. If we're entering a position where there's only six competitive teams in each league, people are just going to stop watching.
Yeah. And that's the problem for Major League Baseball right now, is that this idea that, you know, there's no difference between an 85 win season and 110 loss season. Makes it, you know, like, I love baseball, and I, you know, but I've only been now, you know, I've been to fewer Mariners games than I have, not because I don't like it, but it's just because, you know, the team is hopeless. You know, there's just not, you know, there's only so much, you know, the, you know, it's very difficult to attract people to teams that lose 100 games here. And in the Mariners case, I don't really have a problem with it. They've tried to be competitive until this year, you know, fine. But, you know, there's these, the Marlins and the Royals, the Orioles, you know, these teams that aren't even trying to compete over multiple years. You know, it makes for a dreary product. And again, even, you know, baseball is actually the one sport where you can at least point to some examples. So, you know, yes, the Cubs and Astros were bad for several years and then won. But even that's somewhat misleading, in that there are many teams that are bad for a lot of years and don't get good. But the other thing, too, is that if you look at it, both the Astros and Cubs only had one key player they got with the top three pick. You know, the Astros got the shortstop with the top three pick. I believe the Cubs got Rizzo. But, you know, really the Astros and Cubs won because they're good organizations. You know, it's not as if, you know, Theo Epstein and the people running the Astros, you know, could only put together a good team if they had lots of number one picks. You know, they found a lot of players outside of the first round. You know, they do a good job developing talent. You know, and then, but again, there's also, like, what about the Yankees, who aren't winning this year because they're spending a lot of money? You know, they developed a lot of their own players. You know, anybody could have had DJ LeMahieu, you know, so it's not as if, you know, like, you know, it's not really clear why this losing 100 games a year, year after year after year, is supposed to be a better model. Or look what Billy Beane is doing yet again in Oakland. You know, that team has never bottomed out. And yet somehow he's able to find good players and win, you know, 90 or 95 games, you know, just actually trying to put a competitive team on the field. So, you know, this idea that tanking is the only way of building a team is just false. But this idea that it's some sort of, you know, magical insight, you know, it is really bad. And as Eric says, it represents very much this kind of winner-take-all mentality of the new Gilded Age. You know, this idea that, you know, as Tanier says, you know, like, you know, 8-8 seasons aren't the same as 0-16 seasons to the players or to the coaches or to, you know, anybody else.
Right.
You know, that it actually does. You know, this idea that you haven't had a good season if you don't win a championship is like, why? You're like, unless you're a fan of like the Patriots or the late 90s Yankees or whatever, why are you watching sports then? Like, the vast majority of sports years are not going to have a championship. So, like, I don't think either of you two didn't enjoy the Chip Kelly years in Oregon because you didn't win a national championship. You know, it would be sort of stupid. And that's actually one of the things I like about the NCAA is that it sort of assumes that there are, like, victories you can have that fall short of a national championship. So this idea that you can't enjoy a season that's, like, young and exciting and ends up with a close loss in the playoffs – is just ridiculous. And personally, I enjoyed the Seahawks having a pretty competitive team in a rebuilding year last year much more than I would have if they'd, you know, like, traded Russell Wilson for 3 first-round draft picks and, like, oh, maybe we could have a championship team by 2024. Like, who wants that? But that's sort of the logic of this tanking theory. I just don't get it.
All right. Well, so, I mean, having now poured salt into the wounds of as many Browns fans as we can, which, you know, again, is only the Angels' work, let's start just plowing through, I think, a quick and dirty of each division. I mean, we'll see how far we get, but I want to start with, I think it's the AFC East, where you have, I think, Scott, what you have described as Team Trump and then Team Trump, right? And so we all know what the first Team Trump is, but I do want to dance for just a second here that Sam Darnold getting mono and being out for some infinite number of games is the most Jets thing ever. I can't imagine another franchise where it would be more appropriate to that franchise than Sam Darnold just randomly getting mono.
I think that the Jets need to definitely continue to draft USC quarterbacks. It's working out very well for them. and it leads to no embarrassing moments.
Oh, in all fairness to Sam, I actually think he looks – another thing that happened in week one is that is the Adam Gase experience that, according to data – one thing that, you know, for all of you can criticize Todd Bowles for, I think what was promising about Darnold last year is that the Jets let him take shots down the field. And the results of that were kind of ugly early, but in December he was really starting to get it. And the thing is, if you look at Gase's history throughout his coaching experience, he basically specializes in the failed third down completion. That his quarterbacks always lead the league in, like, you know, completions on third down that don't get first downs. So what happens is that means that, you know, your quarterbacks get higher completion percentages, and the NFL rating is sort of biased towards high completion percentages. You know, there are fewer embarrassing throws on tape. You know, you're not going to get a lot of ugly interceptions, but you don't win. Like, you can't win like that. And so Darnold last year was really being aggressive. And in week one, his passes traveled the shortest distance of I believe, any starting quarterback. So Gase was just doing this shit again where, you know, the basic idea is to, like, you know, throw for, you know, like, you know, is to, you know, get a 3rd and 8 and throw a 4-yard completion. And so hiring Gase is just going to, like, would have ruined Darnold. So in some sense, the mono may be the best thing for Darnold long term. You know, if the Jets go 2-14 and Gase gets fired, you know, then they might actually have somebody who can, like, you know, can train him before he's done. But yeah, no, that's just it really is something what's going on there. And I just nothing about that organization makes sense. And it's like, why would you? I just, like, what is it about Gase's 3 years in Miami that make you think he's the coach you want? I don't understand. Nothing about Gase makes any sense at all. Like, there's just, like, literally his only credential is that he stood on the sideline while Peyton Manning has, like, his 9th MVP caliber season or something. It's really amazing what he's been able to milk out of that.
Well, I mean, you know, we're not the first people to note this, but, you know, one of the most remarkable things about the NFL is the sheer level of incompetence at the managerial level and the fact that these terrible, proven awful people get hired again and again to do terrible work and they never seem to improve and yet they continue to get jobs. And I think that's, you know, for cultural reasons, for racial reasons too, really. I think that, you know, when you have a capable person like Belichick, for as awful as he is, the fact that he sees through all of that crap and has his own vision and sticks to it, even if it sometimes is unorthodox, I think is telling, because these other people just get hired over and over and over again. I mean, my favorite example of this is one that's very little known, but it's the offensive coordinator stylings of former Oregon quarterback Bill Musgrave, who has been the offensive coordinator for like 13 different teams, each one a horrible offense, at best average. And yet he continues.
I believe he was fired by the Raiders in like week four. How are you fired by the Raiders in week four? Yeah. Right? I mean, that's crazy. And he still got other jobs.
Yeah. So, but he's one of the guys, right? He's one of the guys now. And so between that and then when they do try to make an adjustment, it's, you know, the kind of thing that Arizona's doing where, you know, let's hire Cliff Kingsbury, even though, you know, he was a mediocre college coach because, you know, the Rams also hired a young guy that actually worked well. So clearly all young guys with offensive minds must be the answer.
And anybody who's ever had a cup of coffee with Sean McVay is clearly the next great head coach.
it's no wonder that these teams continue to be total losers.
Now, let's talk about another team in this division, which actually is trying to compete and beat Gase in week one, which is the Bills, who I think are an interesting team in that, like, McDonough has actually done some good things. Like, the Bills had a top three defense last year, and they play hard, and they actually have seemed to at least add some offensive talent this year. And so the really interesting question there is Josh Allen. And I know, you know, I took pretty much the standard issue, like, stat nerd line on him. And I think, Rob, but if I call Rob, you liked him a little more, right? That was
he clearly has – I mean, it's one of those situations where you can certainly envision him being good in the right context, right? But my position was always the man could be an awfully bad quarterback, right? I mean, he needs a lot of help. The skills he's lacking are the ones which I think you've identified are sometimes like the most difficult ones to develop, right? I mean, when you have a college quarterback who's not that accurate, I mean, that's just a massive red light. I mean, that said, I wouldn't have been surprised I still won't be surprised if he turns out to be a more than suitable NFL quarterback.
Yeah, the one thing I will say about him, and I'm still a little skeptical, but he is a legitimately like remarkable athletic talent. You know, he's not one of these guys who's like a white guy with like a strong arm, but, you know, he legitimately has unique skills, which I think makes him more likely to be a development outlier. But, you know, I mean, again, I would like the Bills more if you know, they drafted a couple other quarterbacks. But having said that, I am at least impressed with the organization that, you know, that they're going, you know, they're trying to put a defense around him. And Allen does seem like the kind of guy who he's going to, he's going to need to, have a competitive team. But, you know, that they at least are trying, you know, to build a serious organization around him. So I'm actually kind of interested in that story because, you know, if any team in that division is going to emerge as any. And that's, you know, and it's true that, you know, Patriots fans point out that, you know, their record against other divisions is as good as their record within the division. And it's true, like in the late 2000s when actually the Jets were amazingly credible. Remember when Rex Ryan looked like a good NFL coach? It feels like 100 years ago. And even the Dolphins and Bills weren't terrible. But for the last 3 or 4 years, the Patriots have definitely been advantaged by how bad the division is. Like, compare the Patriots to the Chargers last year, who were arguably as good, but, you know, had to play an extra game and then fly across the country the next week to play Foxborough. You know, you put the Patriots in a division with the Chiefs, so that one small advantage the Patriots have now is basically a guaranteed divisional position and a much easier path to the wild card because they're playing, you know, horrible teams 6 games a year. So, you know, I at least like the idea of, you know, like, it would be nice if some other team in this division could be, you know, and I could see the Bills giving the Patriots some trouble, you know, that to beat the Patriots, you know, you need a pass rush and you need a quarterback who's willing to make some big plays. And the Bills definitely have that. And we'll see about the offense. Although one thing I will also note is that New England secondary is amazing. And the core is a guy that Buffalo let walk for no obvious reason. Like another triumph of tanking. Like, don't you think the Bills, you know, it's like, quick, I just, you know, so again, like, it's just another question of like how many guys have the Bills and Jets let get away who have played great for the Patriots. It's really infuriating.
Right. So I think at this point we actually have to do stop and talk a little bit about the other situation in New England, right? Right. Whereas, you know, sort of, I mean, I think all of us sort of followed Antonio Brown with the Raiders situation with just, you know, the sort of car wreck, dreadful, glee of watching a truly awful. Although, you know, say what you will about the Raiders, they did come out, right? They did turn out and they beat the Broncos, I believe. So, you know, for all that is messed up with that organization, they did show up, and the players, I think, deserve a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, being in New England and in all of this and being around a gazillion Pats fans and the Brown thing. I mean, I think that it's all plus for New England. I mean, if he doesn't work out, and hey, look, he very well may not. I mean, look how many weapons they were able to use last week against the Steelers. I mean, they just tore the Steelers apart. And, you know, they don't have a lot of superstars at this point. You know, unless you consider Edelman a superstar, which everybody here does, but you know, he's not with any other team and any other quarterback. He's pretty average receiver at best, but you know, I mean, as they stand right now, even without a single really significantly above average offensive player, including a pretty bad offensive line, except for Tom Brady, they're still, you know, one of only two teams, I think, that have that really have a serious chance of coming out of the AFC. So, you know, if Brown works out for them, then it's all gravy. If he doesn't, the Patriots are still probably fine.
Yeah, and this is the best defense they've had in a long time, so yeah.
Maybe you can speak a little bit, Scott, because I'm actually – so the situation with Brown, as I understand it right now, is complicated because there is a civil suit but not a criminal inquiry, which puts the Patriots and the NFL in a difficult situation. Is that what I am understanding, right, the current issue with sort of the charges or the allegations against Antonio Brown?
Yeah, so there's a suit against Brown, which, you know, if a sort of former a gymnast who met when they were both at Central Michigan, I believe. And so he basically hired her to be a personal trainer, and you know he you know there's sort of an escalating series of sexual assaults, which the last one was apparently a forcible rape. You know, obviously the allegations are credible. It's tricky to say. I mean, you know, I don't necessarily think the Patriots are wrong to play him this week. You know, it's always what the NFL should do about off the field issues is always a very fraught one. And I'm torn between, you know, I think it's bad when domestic abusers and sexual assaulters are playing in the league. On the other hand, you know, sort of giving Roger Goodell the unlimited arbitrary authority to suspend people for, you know, has not worked out great either. So I think that, you know, I don't really have a problem with the Patriots saying, like, we take these allegations seriously. You know, the league is investigating them and we'll do what the league says. You know, there's different ways of looking at it. You know, I could certainly see a case that these allegations seem credible. We're going to, you know, going to suspend Antonio with pay until they can be investigated. But I don't think what the Patriots, you know, as much as I would like to criticize them, and as concerned I'm in, and we should certainly take these allegations seriously. But I'm not sure. I think that, you know, sort of, you know, he's eligible to play until an investigation reveals that he shouldn't be eligible is not an unreasonable stance. But I'm open to persuasion on that. I don't know how Eric feels about that, but
I think that. Like the with pay is a really important consideration here, right? Because, you know, I think that the Patriots would also be in a fairly strong position if they just said, look, you know, we're going to suspend him. We're not going to put him on the field, but we're going to continue to pay him, right? You know, at least while the investigation is ongoing, right? Because, yeah, the allegations are credible. You know, in a universe in which they turn out to sort of disappear for whatever reason, the man is still being paid, right? He's still being paid for his job. And so, you know, his livelihood has not been destroyed by, you know, what we would assess to be false allegations, right? At the same, and then the Patriots would also, in this situation, avoid, you know, where you are putting a rapist on the field.
Yeah, and that's actually, now that I think that's probably the best solution. You know, that if you suspend him without pay, then, you know, that's just giving NFL owners a huge precedent to essentially void contracts based on you know, right. Particularly because right. It will also be used for allegations less serious than this. I mean, let's be frank. You know, right. It's going to be like, you know, oh, well, he's incredibly accused of smoking pot. Guess, you know, his guaranteed contract, just, you know. But, you know, I think that, you know, the allegations are serious and credible enough that, you know, the best move is probably like, you know, you're getting paid. You know, and again, now, having said that, I don't know in terms of the collective bargaining what the legality of that is. But yeah, as far as I know, you never have to play somebody.
Yeah, I just looked that up. There is a special list designation that places players called the commissioner's exempt list that removes people from the team's active list while still paying them.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the best, you know, the best solution until an investigation can be completed. You know, don't risk putting a sexual assaulter on the field, but don't deprive them of pay without an investigation. I mean, I think that seems like probably the fairest solution.
All right, so we are actually running a little bit long, so let's blow through these other three, the three lesser divisions in the AFC. Which to my understanding, include the AFC South, where Scott, you are not high on the Titans. Is that correct?
Yeah, and actually, I've sort of been a defender, and obviously, I like them more now after week one. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting division in that, you know, like, I really don't like the Texans organization. I don't have any faith in O'Brien at all. But, you know, they have, like, as long as Watson is healthy, he is a tremendous quarterback. And that game against New Orleans is amazing. You know, and they obviously have a, you know, they've got DeAndre Hopkins, who I think you can argue is the best receiver in the league. You know, they've got some more surrounding talent now. You know, they obviously have J.J. Watt and Merciless on defense. You would like them if they hadn't traded, you know, Javonte and Clowney for a six-pack of Red Hook ESB. But, you know, I myself will take that. But, you know, they're certainly vulnerable. And the other, there actually are some interesting teams in the division, you know. So I think that the Titans, you know, sort of you look at them and it's not clear how they keep winning. But, you know, Vrabel has done a good job there. And they have, you know, they compete hard. And again, they looked very good against the Browns last week. You know, and the Colts, you know, despite losing Luck, you know, one of the tragedies of that situation is the Colts have a much better coaching and talent infrastructure than they have in a long time. Like, you know, Reich and Ballard have done a really good job building that team up. And I think, you know, and we saw this in the first week, I mean, I think they could be pretty competitive even with Brissett. And then also, here's an interesting one, and you two particularly being Pac-10 watchers, what do we make of the quarterback in Jacksonville? Because I think there's a real chance that, you know, for years, air raid quarterbacks had a tendency to fail, even if they had played well. But we now have a big exception to that in Patrick Mahomes. And it's sort of, I think Doug Farrar implied in his new book, you know, there's two possibilities here. One is that air raid quarterbacks failed because their stats were misleading and they put up numbers that you couldn't do in the NFL. But another way of looking at it is teams would draft air raid quarterbacks and then try to make them, you know, pocket passers with, you know, two wide receiver for, you know, that as NFL teams get more comfortable using air raid concepts in their offense, you know, some of these guys may pan out. So it really seems to me that Minshew, you know, and again, it's a little weird because he bounced around so much, but like he was legitimately good at Wazoo last year. You know, like I think completion percentage over 70%. You know, he was taking shots down the field. You know, I know he wasn't great in the Apple Cup, but, you know, like, I mean, that's like, it seems to me that for a fifth round flyer, you know, I'm not sure that his performance last week was pure illusion. I'm not willing to call him a good quarterback yet, but do you two think there could be something there or it just look like a fluke?
I got to say that Connor Minshew, NFL.
Isn't
quarter,
his name Garrett?
Yeah, it's a weirder name than Connor. I just
think that's exactly. Yeah, anyway, I never really saw Minshew at Gardner's what it is. Yeah.
Gardner.
Yeah, I never saw Minshew at, you know, thought of him as an NFL quarterback last year at Washington State. I mean, yeah, he was pretty good in that offense and certainly picked Oregon apart. But, you know, I mean, it's so hard to tell out of that offense. So, and it will actually be an interesting experiment. You know, what happens when you, in a modern context here, when you put somebody into an offense that uses some of these ideas, who's not a Mahomes, but who actually could be a functional NFL quarterback. I guess we're going to find out. It's certainly an interesting experiment. As far as the South itself goes, I just feel like, you know, you may very well end up with four teams that are all between 9 and 7, 7 and 9, and they're all kind of okay. I mean, I don't really think much of the Jags, but you could at least see it. So, you know, I mean, who knows what's going to happen there? I guess I would believe more in the Texans, but could the Titans, you know, go 9 and 7 again and win the division? Sure, I don't see any reason why that can't happen.
And at least it's a division where everybody is trying to compete, which I guess, as we said earlier, we like. And that's one thing I like is that, you know, all these teams are sort of credibly trying to put teams on the field, and the organizations may be better or worse. But, you know, even in the, you know, the one thing I have to say about the Texans, I don't like what they did this offseason, but at least it wasn't, you know, like at least they're like they have a window with an excellent quarterback on a rookie contract and they're trying to win. Now, I don't see why you do that and then trade away Clowney, but still, at least they're trying to do things. So I do think that makes this division a little bit more interesting than it's been in a long time. You know, they've got four organizations, and certainly, even if the Minshew thing doesn't work out, I'd much rather like put sort of an unconventional prospect who might be underrated rather than bringing in like Chad Henne or, you know, whatever the, you know, for the, you know, the 18th time, you know, like at least, you know, like I like a higher upside gamble. Like, you know, there's no point in going with a failed prospect when you can see, cause you know, you never know when you might catch lightning in a bottle, you know, but as long as, you know, and he's certainly, you know, more credible. I believe Mr. Trevor Siemian will be starting for the New York Jets this week. So that's some good news for the Browns. Anyway,
all right. So speaking of the Browns, let's the AFC North is another place where you know our what we expected may have been changed by week one, right? And so Scott, I know you had Pittsburgh and then Baltimore and then Cleveland,
right.
And you know, I guess part of this question here is, you know, is Pittsburgh as bad as they looked, or was it just the Patriots who made them look bad? And we come back to this, which we've already talked a little bit about: is Baltimore as good as it looks?
Well, you know, that's hard to say. I mean, again, anybody can beat up on Miami, but they did beat up on it by a lot. And then Pittsburgh did look terrible. So,
yeah, like Pittsburgh looked awful. I mean, they looked just, you know,
and it's, terrible. You know, at some point, Pittsburgh wasn't that great. And they didn't look that great last year either. So,
yeah.
So I guess I'd probably think Baltimore here, but I really don't see it as Cleveland. Yeah, so I think Baltimore probably is the more solid team now, but you know, that's another division that could probably be pretty close. But then, but again, I think any of those teams maybe top out of 10-6.
Yeah, I think that after week one, I don't want to overreact. You know, I would probably be inclined to put Baltimore slightly above Pittsburgh, although, you know, again, it's obviously there's a big difference between playing the Dolphins and playing the Patriots. But still, you know, having said that, it's one thing to lose to the Patriots. You know, the Steelers were just uncompetitive. You know, and basically everything that you're concerned about, you know, and again, and the thing is, it's not even, you know, that it was probably time for Brown to leave Pittsburgh. You know, I think they're right not to give Bell a big second contract. And I guess Bell's shoulder, another thing going on for the Jets, that Bell just had an MRI on his shoulder. So, you know, I think it's fine, but they still need to replace those players. You know, that still, you know, like Antonio Brown, whatever you think about him, was, you know, arguably the best wide receiver in this league since Randy Moss. You know, he's really, you know, that's not something you can just replace easily.
I mean, assuming Juju Smith-Schuster is simply going to be a number one receiver, yeah, I don't know about that. You know, and then you go down the line to the number two and three receivers, and you know, the Patriots cornerbacks just totally dominated those guys.
Yeah. Now, I have no doubt that Washington is going to be a tremendous fantasy pick, you know, as it comes down to, you know, but in all seriousness, it's, you know, that definitely, if you were concerned about the Steelers, you would not have been alleviated by that. But I would caution to say that, like, despite the disappointing year last year, like, Roethlisberger was still, and again, not somebody I root for, but was still one of the five or six best quarterbacks in the league last year, you know, that the defense looks improved. But I think the really striking thing about that Patriots game is that, like, you know, basically, you know, Belichick is just so much head and shoulders. But it's not like Tomlin's a bad coach. Tomlin is, you know, like a top 10 and arguably top 5 coach. It's just shocking how large the gap is between Belichick and the rest of the league. And you saw that again. It's like Sean McVay is certainly one of the best coaches in the league, whatever you thought about him. And in the Super Bowl, Belichick just embarrassed him, like, just, you know, just beyond. So it really is. It is something. So I guess I would say I wouldn't overreact. But, you know, the one thing is that, you know, Cleveland's opportunity, and now they get the Jets in week two, you know, if they can get things turned around, there is the possibility that Pittsburgh is a lot more vulnerable. And it's a good division for a wild card team to come out of, because it's going to be really tough for the South to generate a wild card team, because, you know, all four teams aren't bad, unless Minshew is just a disaster. So I do think that there's a real big, I think, given how, you know, given that the Bengals probably aren't going to be very good this year, you know, if the Steelers slip, that's the Browns, you know. So I wouldn't write off the Browns for a while, you know, again, despite the concerns we all have. You know, I wouldn't be shocked to see them get to a wild card, you know, if it just turns out that Pittsburgh isn't going to launch. But it's premature to say that. I'll be interested to see the Steelers over the next couple of weeks. And New England does have a history of owning them pretty badly. So, you know, so I think I'll wait and see. But I am most, you know, I think you have to be impressed with what the Ravens look like. You know, they're you know, and it's not just at all. It's like the quarterback looked great. The receivers they picked up look great. It looks like they've lost some veterans on defense, but look very good. You know, Harbaugh is a very good coach. So, you know, I think you have to see them as the solidest team in the division right now.
All right, so I will also say that I invested in Baker Mayfield in two different fantasy leagues, including the LGM fantasy league, and so I really needed that to work out. Let's jump to a division which, in fact, does have some terrible teams, which is the AFC West, right? Where at least half of the division is pretty awful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the Broncos. I take a lot of joy in Horseface, destroying the Broncos for the next 35 years, and the Bolin family engaging in fighting after dealing with a very annoying and obnoxious Broncos fan brother for many, many, many years. To see him dispirited gives me joy. So that's a personal thing, but they're so bad. And I mean, that's a division that just feels like it's already over, that it's the Chiefs are going to probably go 14-2, although without Tyreek Hill, we'll see. The Chargers are probably going to go 11-5 or so, good solid team. And then the other two is just, who cares?
Yeah. And at least, and it really says, I mean, and it's just, like the Joe Flacco thing is just, it's not new. It's been 4 years, and he hasn't just been disappointing. Like, he has been a replacement level quarterback. And as we see, the Ravens are a good infrastructure. It's not like you can plausibly say, well, nobody can succeed with the Ravens, give him the brilliant offensive coaching of the, Denver Broncos, and he'll be, who is the Broncos offensive coordinator? It was some guy I hadn't heard of, but that they have a defensive, and again, there's also Fangio is a great defensive coordinator, but when a guy's been in the league this long and has never been given a head coaching job before, I'm given that success, and although in fairness, there's no recent Bronco defensive coordinators who would provide an example of how being a great coordinator doesn't make you a great head coach. So,
to go back to an earlier conversation, it may not surprise you that the Broncos offensive coordinator last year was one Bill Musgrave.
I was about to bring that up.
Again, Flacco is what he's been. But, Elway's preference, and of course, it was really bad last year. They brought in a mediocre quarterback who was a little shorter, and that didn't work out. So Elway is full on back to the, 6 foot, the 6 foot four or five, tall white mannequin. But Flacco just looks hideous. And again, I think you do have to respect, and I guess one thing, you have to respect the fact that the Raiders didn't roll over. That would have been a very easy game for them to just kind of, blow off. And at least, they tried. And that shows you that Gruden at least seems to command the respect of his players. But there's still not, there's not a lot of talent there. I sort of tend to agree that the two teams are bad. But the difference is that the Raiders are a young team that shouldn't expect to be good. They don't really have their future quarterback in place, whereas the Broncos are wasting, one of the greatest defensive players ever with a lot of surrounding talent. A competent quarterback could make that team competitive, and Elway's inability to find a competent quarterback is just truly staggering. It really boggles the mind. Because of that, it's very hard to imagine the Chiefs not winning the division. And the Chargers have some problems, but I think a wild card team is coming into that division just because the two bad teams are so bad. So you have to think the Chargers are at least getting the playoffs.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that feels like the easiest pick right now, right? That division has two teams, and the Chargers are going to be the number two team. So we're going to have to call this just the AFC preview, and we're going to have to come back maybe next week and do the NFC preview, because we're already about 45 minutes for this.
Sure.
So on behalf of LGM, for our listeners, I would like to thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right, and Lawyers Against Money listeners, we will return hopefully next week. After another week, we'll give us a better guess on what the NFC is going to look like, right? So our picks look even less, hopefully a little bit less dumb, because we'll have a little bit more information.
Yeah, always like the chance to make predictions with more information. Less more.
Exactly. Well, we're going to come back in week 10 with the NFC preview and see how things are going.
Exactly. All right, talk to you soon.
All right, well, thank you much, and we look forward to hearing from you again.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find good music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through a PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.